Good morning. All right, it's our fourth week together. So as I said, I want to look back at some important points before we move on from everything we know about the creation of the universe. And you're going to need a handout today because we are going to be flipping through a lot of verses. I pointed out that ancient Israel had devolved into idolatry during their time in Egypt. And some years ago, I went to the Ramses exhibit in Memphis. I don't know if y'all did. I like Egyptian museum pieces. But at that one, I was really struck by how every item, combs, makeup brushes, kitchen utensils, had some little idol carved on them. So I think Israel would have just been immersed in idolatry. And it explains why they so quickly flipped to wanting a golden calf at Mount Sinai. It was what would seem normal to them. So as I said the first week, they needed to understand and trust God to achieve their part in God's plan. And Moses needs to not only set them free from slavery, he needs to set them free spiritually. And he wants to give them a biblical view of reality by telling about their history beginning at creation. Now, as a reminder, in the ancient world, people believed the universe was ruled by gods who were just powerful people who were part of the observable universe. The pagan gods were also immoral and behaved really badly. So no idea of a moral god before Moses' account. So Moses' creation account is a passionate argument against these pagan myths, and that's the way I'm looking at the teaching. It's not a science, account. Science wasn't invented for thousands of years. Later authors also called their audiences back to the faith when they fell into idolatry by telling them about where they came from, and we're going to look at some of those today. And so the biblical accounts argue against paganism by basically giving Israel radically new and different information about God and creation. And it's so radically new that modern scholars that study all of these things are mystified by how such a sophisticated system of beliefs, totally unlike anything before it, could have just appeared in Israel with no apparent beginning. One of them, in a book I've got, even said it... It is as if it was supernaturally communicated, which is what the Bible says. Now, the authors told Israel that there's one God responsible for the universe and that there is a spiritual reality beyond the universe. And they told them it's important not to confuse the creation with the creator. Before Israel, you never had the idea of creation as an it. Yeah, but in the Bible, it's an it. It's not a God. And the Apostle Paul told the church in Rome, which was made up mostly of Gentiles who were saved out of a worldview with an ungodly view of origins, that men have exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served something created instead of the Creator. And this seems to be the basic default tendency of humanity in rebellion against God. And it remains true today. So we are surrounded by a world with an ungodly worldview, and we need correct information from the Bible. As we went through the scriptures about the beginning of the universe in the last 2 weeks, we saw that God spoke the cosmos into existence as something brand new with no pre-existing conditions or materials. So I wonder if you've noticed, as I did, how often we subconsciously imagine God as just a powerful human being, just as the ancient world did. According to the Bible, he's not confined to our dimensions of space and time. He invented them. But when we wonder how God can hear the prayers of millions of people at the same time, or how God can know what's going to happen in the future, or who created God, we're subconsciously imagining God as confined to the universe as we are. When we wonder how God can work miracles if they violate the laws and properties of nature, we're once again imagining God as confined by the properties of the universe, like a powerful human being, instead of the one who created all of these things and existed before them. He's pre-existent. And I gave you examples from scientific discovery about the truthfulness of the Bible's description of the cosmos beginning from nothing that we can perceive, which gives us, as I said, confidence that the rest of the Bible describes things we can't prove, like God in the spiritual realm, just as accurately. Last week I went over four scriptures that talked about what God was doing before he began to create the universe, and I was asked a question about ideas that appear contradictory, like predestination and free will. I want to circle back to that. I said that while this may appear to be a contradiction to us, it may in actuality be a paradox that makes perfect sense when you're a being not confined to our physical reality. But I didn't really explain what a paradox was. So let me give you an example I saw a while ago that made it clear to me. Suppose I drew a triangle on this paper, and I said to you, a triangle is never a circle. You'd probably agree with that. But then suppose that my next statement is, a triangle is always a circle. And then I say, those two statements are true at the same time. A triangle is never a circle, and a triangle is always a circle. So that appears to be a contradiction or an impossibility. But if I explain to you that in two dimensions, a triangle is never a circle, and in three dimensions, a triangle is a cone. And if you remember from high school geometry, a cone is just a series of concentric circles. Or if you don't remember high school geometry, maybe you've seen the kids' toys that have the little plastic circles that get smaller. So those two statements that appear to be contradictory are really a paradox. And so a paradox is something that doesn't make sense until you consider the possibility of extra dimensions. Perhaps the things that seem to be impossible contradictions in the Bible are just paradoxes, and they make sense when you consider that God and heaven exist outside our four dimensions. I want to go back to one other question that I said I would research. Some people are retranslating the Bible and inserting he or she to refer to God. And I was asked if the Bible really refers to God as he. The short answer is yes. It really means he. And when it refers to God as Father, that's not parent. When it refers to Christ as the Son, that's not child. But as I said at the time, when we get to the Garden of Eden, it's obvious that bearing the image of God requires both male and female. And so that's really emphasized, that you image of God is both male and female. And there's some images of God in the Bible that sound, you know, like feminine actions to me. So if we think about this controversy, which is going on in parts of the church right now, it's also an example of people imagining God to be a powerful human being. And I'm going to use a crude example just for the shock value. Do we really want to argue about whether God stands up or sits down to relieve himself? God doesn't relieve himself. The Bible says God is spirit. He is not sexual. That's clear. Whenever we talk about God, we're in metaphor. We say that God speaks and hears, but we don't imagine that he has vocal cords or eardrums. It's kind of the only way we can really relate to or understand God. And if you think about it, actually, we are made in the image of God. And so the reason we see and hear is because God sees and hears. We just have a physical reality to that. So the Bible does speak of God as he, and it's a metaphor. But you can't change the metaphor or you're in idolatry. So that's why I'd say you can't substitute he or she, parent or father, even if the language, you know, weren't so emphatic. When you re-image God, you have an idol. And I just don't think we're free to change that image, even though we don't understand it totally. And in the church, There in Christ, there is no racial differences. There is no male or female. There's no socioeconomic differences. We are unity in diversity, just as God is. So I did want to circle back to that because I said I'd research it. You know, as I said, if you were making up a religion, you wouldn't make it so radically different from what we can imagine or understand, like those paradoxes. But it also wouldn't accurately describe what scientists are recognizing as the implications of the scientific discoveries that the cosmos and all its properties came into existence from nothing we can perceive, just as Hebrews said. One is that the Creator must exist because all matter and energy, our dimensions of space and time, came into being from a source beyond itself. So there had to be a cause for all of these things. The Creator, or causal agent, with capital C and A, as scientists refer to him, because they now recognize there's got to be a cause, an intelligence cause. But the causal agent or Creator must be greater than the effect he created. So God's greater than the universe, the entire universe. And the Creator must be transcendent, as the Bible says, because the act of causing these effects must take place independent of them. So though scientists don't recognize the causal agent as the God of the Bible, as I said last week, it's the only holy book that accurately describes these things. And the descriptions were written thousands of years ago. Now, I told you the first week when I laid out how I thought this class would go that I wanted to introduce you to the two things that really enhance my ability to read and understand the Bible, particularly the Old Testament, for myself, because I really want you to have the same benefit and leave this class being able to understand it for yourself and not just be dependent on sermons or so forth. And the first was that I read the Bible from cover to cover, and the second was I was introduced to here in the Anglican School of Ministry at St. Andrews around 10 years ago. And it's how the style of writing that these talented biblical writers used points to the meaning that the author wants to communicate. And these clues had kind of gone right over our head for a very long time because this style hasn't been around since around 500 B.C., but they've been rediscovered fairly recently, and once you begin to see them, they're used over and over again. The style and structures the writers used highlights the meaning the inspired biblical writer wants to communicate us. Now, in school, when we read a book, our teachers were always asking, what does that book mean to you? You really can't do that with the Bible if you want to get its meaning. We're not inspired like the biblical writers are. If we want to hear from God, we need to hear the message God gave to these writers, not use our own imagination. The Holy Spirit illuminates the Bible to those who are believers, but it does not make us inspired. So we want to recognize the subtle and nuanced meaning about God these writers were communicating. As one commentator said, we must first know how the text means before we can know what it means. And so I want to begin introducing you to these tools today instead of waiting till next week. So today I want to look at the remaining verses about what the Bible tells us about the creation of the universe that's not included in Genesis 1 before we turn there. Specifically, I want to look at verses that speak of how God designed the universe and the earth. The end of last week, we looked at Psalm 104:2, which is at the top of your page, which begins with the first thing you might see at creation, the appearance of light. We can't be sure that that's not just an introductory statement, but the end of the same verse definitely refers to what happens at the beginning of the universe or after the beginning of the universe. And what we want to look at in detail today, the expansion of the universe after its creation. Psalm 104:2 is a word picture of the universe being stretched out in a way both ancient and modern listeners can understand. It's not a new concept in Psalm 104. God's expansion of the universe is the first piece of basic information about creation that the author of the older book of Job introduces in Job 9:8. And it's a concept that's repeated in 11 verses by five authors throughout the Old Testament. So I would say that's a theme. Before we look at these verses, I want to show you how you could find verses like this on your own if you noticed a strange concept like this and wanted to do some more research. Now, you could use a concordance. I'll give you a hint. Don't just buy Strong's Concordance because you heard that's the best concordance and find out it matches the old King James Version, which is not the version that you're using. So you can't find the words, but get a concordance that matches your version of the Bible. And then you'd look for all the instances of the word stretch or stretches. But that would show you many examples of this word that have nothing to do with the universe. And you may not have a concordance with you when you're reading. So I take some help from my Bible. Most Bibles have notes in the margins beside each verse. And the translators have already done the work of saying where else in the Bible is this same concept introduced. So it'll bring you to other verses. So, for example, I looked in my margins by Psalm 104:2 in one translation, and didn't do this in every translation. I don't know why they don't all point to the same verses, but they don't. And it referred me to Job 9:8 and Isaiah 40:22. And so then I went to those verses and looked at the verses in the margins by those, and that led me to other verses and so on. So that's just a shortcut, how you can benefit from reading the Bible from cover to cover by taking some help from the translators who've, you know, already done this work for you. So the first tool I want to introduce you to is the use of repetition in this ancient Hebrew writing style and how it's used to help us understand the Bible's message. You can see a description of this tool on the second page of your handout. When modern writers compose, they try to use a variety of words. The repetition of words and phrases in this biblical writing style is used strategically, and that's the key here. When biblical writers repeat a word or a phrase, the repetition is a signal to a listener that this is the subject, important concept, or a thing. Now, the individual who recognized this pattern and publicized it called it a lead word or leap word. I don't know if he was German, but... So these are not just ordinary words like the or and, but meaningful words or parts of words that are repeated. And when this occurs, they, as I said, point to the point that the author is trying to make. Now, you may have heard about word repetition before, you know, if you've done a precepts Bible study or some other things, but maybe not recognize just how powerful this tool is. This is also a tool that's helpful to you as you read the New Testament. You remember almost all the New Testament writers, very familiar with the possible exception of Luke, very familiar with the Old Testament, and use this technique also. A month or two ago, I was sitting in church and had my Bible turned to the passage during the sermon. Frankly, I don't remember if we were looking at Paul's letter or if we were in the Gospel of John, but I noticed the word believe in two sentences right next to each other, and I kind of perked up because you begin to see these things, you know, once you're looking for them. And I looked at the paragraphs before and after the sentence, and then I was looking at columns before and after the sentence, and the word believe just kept recurring. So felt a little to me as if the writer was hitting me upside the head with a 2x4 saying, you know, it's all about what you believe. So this tool is used throughout the Bible. It's especially important in these Old Testament narrative accounts. For example, when we look at Genesis, God, or He with a capital H, occurs more than 20 times in that one, Genesis 1, that one short chapter. God's the subject of every transformative verb. So it's pointing us to the fact that Genesis 1 is about God. And we'll see that other parts of Genesis 1 are repeated for emphasis also. So we're going to try and notice repetition when it occurs. Some of you who are actually good at literature may pick up on these tools easier than I have. I've had to study them, and they're not totally intuitive, but I'm getting better. Such frequent repetition of the expansion of the universe, as I said, by so many authors, then communicate some important information. Now, normally, you look at the repetition within the context you're looking at, maybe within the entire book, other books by the same writer, and then the whole Old Testament. So that's why I was going to wait until next week to introduce this concept. But, you know, all these writers are familiar with each other, and they repeat this same thing. And as I said, no other characteristic of creation described so many times by so many different authors. This is their number one piece of evidence for God as the creator, by looking at the creator in terms of numbers of times it's mentioned. And they used it, a number of writers, which we'll see, used it to bring people back to the biblical worldview. You see number on your sheet by the prophet Isaiah. He was speaking to a people who were trusting the world around them rather than God. So Isaiah repeatedly shows God in control of all of creation. Jeremiah wrote to a people who had turned aside to idols and away from this awesome God who created and controls the universe. Zechariah wrote to God's people living around a generation later who were discouraged and had forgotten who God is, the one who stretches out the universe. So all of these authors point to this aspect of creation to bring God's people back into covenant relationship when they'd fallen away. They tell us what happened as the universe formed and how it formed, namely by God's action. So let's look at these verses using our tool and see what they tell us about God. Psalm 104:2 shows God powerful enough to cause and control the expansion of the universe as easily as we might stretch out a curtain. This language shows that the universe is growing or expanding. Notice that Isaiah 40:22 repeats the same word picture of a curtain. It's interesting that the picture chosen implies that the universe is flat, spread out like a curtain. But it doesn't state that clearly. Still, it's a very accurate word picture from what we know today. Next, I want to look at the verbs used in these verses and what they tell us about this aspect of the design of the universe. Three different Hebrew verbs or verb tenses are used to describe this cosmic stretching. It's a little hard to see in English. Seven of the verses use a form of the verb that implies continual or ongoing stretching. So God is continuing to stretch out the universe. The fact that God continues throughout history to control the expansion at a just right rate tells us of his continuing care for our dwelling place. He did not just initiate the expansion of the universe when he was creating and then step away. Although he's no longer creating, he remains and has remained actively involved through time in carefully managing the expansion rate of the universe. So, as I said, it shows our ongoing care for our home. Now, four verses use the verb form that means that the stretching of the universe was completed or finished some time ago. So what's that about? It's finished, but it's ongoing. That the Bible claims that the stretching out of the heavens is both finished, it's ongoing, is most evident in Isaiah 40:22, where you find two different verbs used in two different forms. So this one verse literally indicates that God is both continuing to stretch out the heavens and has stretched them out in the past. So this simultaneously finished and ongoing aspect of cosmic stretching is what is postulated by physicists today. The universe expanded at a much more accelerated rate immediately after creation. That after this initial expansion, the expansion rate continues at a slower, continued, controlled, just right rate, really. And that expansion is ongoing. So earlier I said that the verb stretches is a poetic description that people of all time could understand. Last week we talked about God creating dark with a geographic location and discussed the recent discovery of dark energy. So if that's a pretty recent discovery, in fact there were the spacewalkers yesterday were fixing something to help them examine dark matter. But if the scientific theories about dark energy are verified, it's the self-stretching property of the surface of the universe or the space-time fabric. That's actually why the universe is expanding. Space stretches itself. I wonder, and this is just me wondering, okay, if the verb stretching is not just a poetic way of saying the universe is expanding, as I said earlier, but it's an accurate description of why it's expanding. God is stretching out the surface of the universe. The physicist Krauss, and I don't know if he's an agnostic or an atheist, but he's not a believer, calls this behavior of dark energy the most extreme fine-tuning problem known in physics. Now, this fine-tuning, other examples of fine-tuning found in creation, pose a real problem for the atheistic and agnostic worldviews. The universe expands at just the right rate throughout its history to get the conditions that make advanced life possible. And nothing else is even in anywhere in nature is anywhere close to as fine-tuned as the expansion rate of the universe. So it's the most extreme example of fine-tuning. And fine-tuning does not happen by chance. It requires an intellect. Since only a personal being can possess and use intellect and power, then the cosmic creator must be a personal being. They're still looking for another explanation, but they recognize that. Another phrase or concept we see repeated in these verses is found in Job 9:8, which emphasizes that God acted alone. Isaiah 44:24 repeats this concept for emphasis, all alone, by myself. Just imagine how powerful and how intelligent God must be in just this one aspect of creation. We see another meaningful repetition by the prophet Jeremiah, who also shows God controlling the expansion of the universe. And notice that he uses this aspect of the universe's design as proof of God's power, wisdom, care, and intelligence. Jeremiah tells us why the universe is in the shape it is and why it is expanding, namely God's discretion and understanding. We all have times in our lives when we question why God's allowing something to happen. Perhaps we question his judgment. I know I have. Last week we saw that God is always present, so he has perfect knowledge of the future that we lack. This week, in these verses, we see just how much wiser and more intelligent God is than man. So his judgment will always be superior to ours as well. Just helpful to me to kind of remember these things. Now, two of these verses remind us that the same God who controls the universe's expansion created us. Isaiah 44:24 states that God forms mankind from the womb, and has formed each of us before birth. And Zechariah adds that God forms the spirit of man within him. Also notice what's communicated about God by the names he is given in these verses. In Isaiah 42:5, he's the Lord Yahweh, the I Am, which means the self-existent or eternal God. This name is always used in connection with covenants with God's people. It's a relationship name. He's also called our Redeemer and our Maker. And we're going to see examples in creation that God's always been a Redeemer. One final thought on this aspect of the cosmos is expanding. Last week we talked about what the Apostle Paul calls the law of decay. And I said that this verse shows the universe will not exist eternally as we will. So we need a new heaven and a new earth. The expansion of the universe also shows why humanity living in eternity needs a new heaven and new earth to be an adequate home. At some point, expansion and gravity will not be matched in the universe as they are today. Expansion's pulling things apart. Gravity's holding things together. As expansion gets more powerful, gravity will get less powerful. So it will not. The universe will not exist forever. It'll be pulled apart. What all these verses tell us by implication is that the universe was not created fully formed as we know it to be today. It began very small, has been expanding throughout the course of its history. That expansion continues today, and God controls the expansion rate. So he's not going to let it spin out of control. The Bible states that God is a creator who all alone not only creates all that exists, but expands the cosmos from its initial small size. So when we think of the expansion of the universe, we're reminded that this aspect of its design is the prime example from nature of God's intelligence, power, wisdom, and care. When we're in need of God's power, wisdom, understanding, his care. Nothing so powerfully demonstrates God's ability to meet that need. You know, if he can control the expansion of the universe by himself, what could possibly be too big for him? Okay, any questions on that before we move on to the creation of stars and constellations? Yes.
I was going to ask you, what version of the Bible do you recommend? We kind of recommend the Standard Version, but which one do you recommend?
Okay, I actually read a lot of versions. But for Bible study, I want a word-for-word translation. Some of them are thought-for-thought. They're fine for devotion. In fact, sometimes reading them will make you hear things a different way. And they kind of range. King James, New King James is word-for-word. New American Standard is word-for-word, but it is very wooden. It's just not good to me for devotion. But if I were reading New Testament letters, I'd read New American Standard because they're so careful with the verb forms, and I don't read Greek. That's why I look at different translations. I have three study Bibles, and study Bibles are really good. I have Ryrie Study Bible. It's a very good summary. It'll tell you history at the first of it. You can see it has footnotes at the bottom. There are two newer ones. There are different translations that I also have. English Standard Bible, I think, is one. And you can look at it and Ryrie. It's got a whole bunch more at the first of every book, particularly history, and the footnotes may be half a page. The other one that's new is a different translation of the Bible, Holman, and its study Bible is really good, and it's more on, it has more concepts, you know, instead of history, but, you know, they're all good. So I wouldn't use the Living Bible or Peterson's Bible for doing Bible studies. It's just you want a word for word. Every Bible, if you look in the front of it, says this is what the translators were trying to accomplish. A lot of the verses I'm showing to you are New King James. That's my study Bible I've used forever. I have so many notes in the margin I can't I can't write many more in it. And it's word for word. The old King James is not as good for me because I don't do well with Shakespearean English. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I liked your point about the universe expanding in present time, kind of showing that God is like still in control of the universe and not a God that just set things up and walked away. But how do you know, just from these verses, that it wasn't a system he set up to expand in time? Makes sense?
Well, because it keeps saying he's doing this.
But like if he set the system,
he could have set the
system. He still get credit for
it. What it implies though is he's really fine tuning in this aspect. He's really fine tuning that system. So it's not expanding at he didn't just set it up and the expansion rate's just continuous. He's fine tuning it. And it's really all the I'm doing this alone, blah, blah, blah. Now, there are plenty of examples in creation of a system he could have set up and just let it happen. And when we get to Genesis 1, we can talk about some of those. When I look at all of, you know, I did this, it's alone, it's my hand, blah, 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 that to me just says this is something God is, and what the physicist said, this is incredible fine-tuning. It's like 10 to the 200th power fine-tuned. It's, you know, just so much farther away than anything we can do as humans. Yes.
I think Jesus addressed that in John 5 when he said, my Father is always working.
I think he is all he is not creating anymore. And so after Adam and Eve, we wouldn't expect to see any new species being created. Which is kind of puzzling to scientists because there are things going extinct, but nothing new coming into existence like you saw before man. Mm-hmm. But that's what the Bible says. So he's resting from creation. He's not just stepped back and lets everything function by itself. So, yes?
Well, in some of these verses, some of them say are in the present tense stretches.
Yes.
And some of them are the past. Like you said, there's this duality.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you just kind of have to look at the context and say, okay, is this something that he could have just set up the system to work, right? I mean, he sets up reproduction to work on its own, you know? But I don't see that in these verses. I just, see a different emphasis with all the repetition.
And not tempted to think. Like, I'm a systems thinker, so I like to set stuff up as a system, and then, like, so I can ignore it and focus somewhere else, right?
Yeah.
Because I can put my focus only in one place.
Mm-hmm.
And, but God isn't like me.
Yeah.
He can put his focus, and again,
everywhere.
Back to your point of, like, God's not just a really advanced, you know, human.
Right.
Another version of us is like, he can put his focus infinite places.
Mm-hmm.
And so he can simultaneously be fine tuning.
Exactly.
And also in the work of creation.
Right.
And, like, that's really interesting.
The other area where I see God still involved is in the creation of stars and constellations. And it's something that obviously happened at the past. Job 9 and Job 38 lays out this aspect of the design of the universe, describing God creating the stars and groupings of stars, like galaxies and constellations. So God is pictured controlling how stars group together, and it says he binds them and looses them. Interesting term. But astronomers have seen that stars are sometimes stripped from one galaxy and absorbed by another. So it's accurate to speak of stars being bound and loosed in formations. And again, that's not something an ancient observer of the stars would have guessed. They didn't have telescopes that went far enough back in time, you know, to see that. The answer to why there are constellations and galaxies in the configurations we can observe is that God designed them that way and carefully crafted and controlled them over time. Okay, then you go to Isaiah 40 and 45. They show God in control of the stars as well as the expansion of the universe. God's power and care is shown as he names the stars and their clusters and maintains them, so not one is missing. Notice that Psalm 147 and Isaiah repeat that God named the stars. In the Semitic world of that day, naming something shows rulership over it. So to this initial audience, they would have immediately seen, okay, this is, God is saying he has rulership over the stars. This is a reason, for example, that the Babylonian king in the book of Daniel gave new names to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Naming the stars then would have communicated to the original audience that God's in control of the stars because he commands them and calls them by name. He's sovereign, which in that day was a ruler with absolute power. So God's able to call 100 billion trillion stars by name. So knowing billions of humans by name kind of seems small in comparison. These stars are shown as evidence of God's might and power in Psalm 147 and Isaiah 40. And they, again, demonstrate that God's understanding is infinite. Yes?
Can I say something?
Yeah.
A little bit divergent, but I think really interesting. Have you ever seen this thing on Bethlehemstar.com? Well, Bethlehemstar.com, they've taken the current universe, the current constellations. They've run it backward in time to see what the sky would have looked like when Jesus was born.
Uh-huh.
And the stars in the sky, basically with the constellations, said a king is born into a virgin.
That's how
the wise men knew what to look for.
Oh.
Is because the constellations spelled out. I mean, the names of the
they were communicating.
They were in the, God gave those names so that that would be a witness to the birth of Christ.
Interesting.
It's really interesting.
Yeah, okay.
Excuse me.
No, that's very interesting. So let me just finish. We'll have to do the earth next time, which is okay. It kind of goes with Genesis 1, right? Because the earth is already in existence in Genesis 1. So we'll look at a little bit about the earth. But let's talk about that God's care for the stars is also ongoing. How he really remains active within the universe. He didn't just create the stars and step aside. And so he's in control even of the stars and galaxies. And you can see that in those verses. So think about the implication for our lives in relationship with a God this powerful and caring and what we've seen about the stars and the universe. You know, like Job, we can see God's control by looking at the stars, even when events in our lives may appear out of control or when we can't see God's wisdom and understanding in a situation we face. We're also told the great things God has done exceeded even the momentous events of the creation of the universe. So as great as that is, God's done more than that. They're past finding out and wonders without wonder, it says. When we question God's wisdom or power in our life, we can look to the stars and constellations and remember how much greater God is than we can even imagine. He controls, he not only made them, but he controls even the galaxies, not just what happens on Earth. All right, any final questions before we close? Yes.
So I know in like a lot of ancient texts, so the, you know, the Odyssey, the Iliad, the Homer, and then the Epic of Gilgamesh.
Uh-huh.
Like ancient writers use epitaphs,
mm-hmm.
which is just like a repeated word or phrase.
Uh-huh.
Because it was an oral tradition, and they're trying to like
right.
get those images in people's brains. How much of this is like simply words or phrases that, you know, you were talking about repetition.
Mm-hmm.
I teach English, and that is still important. So,
you still repeat.
When you're reading, you know, the Odyssey, you need to know that Odysseus is the man who's never at a loss.
Mm-hmm.
And they change those phrases, but they repeat it all throughout
yeah.
because it's a vital part of his character.
Uh-huh.
Do you think God, like, is that part of what you're talking about when you're saying the form is important?
Yeah, so the content's totally new.
Mm-hmm.
Next week, we want to look at how it's similar to other writings at the time, because basically God is reaching out to a people with a totally different concept of reality than we have today.
Yeah.
They didn't look at the sun and wonder how much hydrogen was going on up there, right? They you know, the sun, they looked at its function, its role, it's telling us winter, you know, is here, blah, blah, blah. And so getting our mind back into the way they thought, because actually God, he doesn't try and just pull them out of that culture into something that they would just reject, because it, like, we've had so much trouble understanding this concept, you know, of the universe, and we're living, you know, in the 21st century. They couldn't have understood it. And so I think what's really great is this is an example of God reaching down into a culture, not requiring people to leave their culture and everything they know, just giving them totally new information in a format they could understand. So there are going to be some similarities. Now, if you start talking about the Iliad, if you read Greek, Roman, other ancient stuff at the time, the style that's different is they give all kinds of descriptions of people, they set the scene, blah, blah, blah. The Bible writers extremely careful not to say anything that'll move you away from the point they're trying to make. So it doesn't matter what someone looks like. It's, he's pointing you to their character, their decisions, etc. And he doesn't put any, they, so these writers don't put anything in to distract. So as I'm trying to be a writer, and by the way, y'all are helping me write my book. I'm kind of rewriting my book. as I'm trying to be a writer, I just more and more appreciate just the extreme artistic talent and literacy of these guys, which I haven't really appreciated in the past. Okay, I think it's time. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you, James.